Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. The devastating campfire, the most destructive in California history, virtually destroyed the town of Paradise and led to the chaotic evacuation of 27,000 people. But also caught in the inferno were thousands of pets owned by the residents of the foothill town. We'll talk to one of the veterinarians that helped treat rescued horses and other large animals in the aftermath of the fire. Later on in the program, we'll also hear from Brian Solecki. Solecki is the campaign manager for congressional candidate Audrey Denny. A month after losing her election bid and the terrible fire that engulfed a part of California's first congressional district, she decided to help a group of campfire survivors by encouraging them to raise money and then accompanying them for a trip to Washington, D.C. to meet with congressional and environmental leaders from Bernie Sanders and Nancy Pelosi to climate activist Bill McKibben. But first, our guest is third-year veterinary student Haley Diekman from the University of California at Davis School of Veterinary Medicine. She was a part of a team of veterinarians that deployed to treat animals rescued from the campfire and wrote about their experiences in the Journal of Equine Healthcare, The Horse. Diekman joined us to talk about it via Skype from Davis, California. Haley Diekman, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you. I'm excited to talk with you guys today.
Can you tell us exactly what the veterinary emergency response team is?
Yes, of course. So UC Davis School of Veterinary Medicine has a program that's the Veterinary Emergency Response Team. And it's actually been around at the school for over 20 years, and it's had varying capacities during that time. But it was created because there was a need to help animals in disasters. And it actually started with just five mules, and they were stuck up in a snowy pass area and were unable to be evacuated down. And so the Veterinary Emergency Response Team created a protocol to actually airlift the mules using a helicopter out off of the snowy pass and down to safety. And that was kind of our first step towards assisting animals when they're in trouble. And since then, we've really grown as an organization and helped in California. And we've also sent different faculty and students to places outside of California and in the United States to assist with emergencies. And these last few years, the Veterinary Emergency Response Team at UC Davis has been really instrumental in caring for the animals that have been affected in the California wildfires.
Well, yes, let's talk about that. What is exactly has your role been? And tell me how big is the response team? And then we'll get to the campfire.
Sure. So the response team's director is Dr. John Madigan, and he is a pioneer in animal welfare and disaster medicine, and he leads the team. And the team consists of a faculty and staff contingent. So those are veterinarians and veterinary technicians that are volunteering their time to assist in emergencies. And then additionally, there's a student component. And we call ourselves the students of the Veterinary Emergency Response Team. And the student contingent right now has about 120 students that are part of the organization. And we have a really robust training program where we bring in different experts in the field of large animals or small animals and have them give lectures and have hands-on activities where students can practice necessary techniques and have a great grasp of what happens in different disasters and kind of the whole incident command system. So it's actually quite a large team. And then as for sending us out on different deployments, we, of course, bring that down to a manageable number and usually send out teams of either 6 to 18 people at a time. And so it's with direct faculty and staff supervision. And then there's a really wonderful educational component where the students can participate as well.
Well, take us back to November 8th. When did you first become aware of the campfire specifically? And then when did it become clear that your team was going to be heading up there?
Yeah, it's It was a busy time, to say the least. I became aware of the campfire shortly after it started, because I was actually a student from the university is from the area, and she reached out to me and said that, you know, she was aware that her family was being evacuated, and she was wondering if the veterinary emergency response team was going to be responding. And so after that, events really cascaded. We are disaster service workers for the county of, or for Yolo County, which is the county where UC Davis is. And Yolo County received a request for aid from Butte County. And also the Medical Reserve Corps, which is a voluntary contingent of the Office of Emergency Services, was activated. And actually the UC Davis Veterinary Emergency Response Team is also a Medical Reserve Corps. So as you can tell, there's a lot of ways that different agencies get deployed in disaster situations. But we actually heard the call from quite a few people, and we became increasingly aware that animals were going to be highly affected in the campfire. And so once we had heard from the proper agencies, and we are always given a mission number, and we follow our deployment very strictly in order to comply with all of the incident command that is in state when there is a disaster. And we deployed with the California Veterinary Medical Association Medical Reserve Corps, and also on behalf of Yolo County.
And when did you actually deploy and get on scene up there?
I think our first day was November 10th. So 2 days after the fire had started, the fire was still very much active at that time. And we were starting to see large scale evacuations of people and animals from Butte County.
And your role came to my attention when I saw a journal article that you wrote in The Horse, which is, I believe, a veterinary magazine for veterinary care for horses. So I'd like to talk to you about the horses. Were you guys involved in rescuing the horses or just treating them once they were off the ridge?
Yeah, so we have filled many capacities in previous disasters, but for the campfire specifically, we were called in to assist with the sheltering and the veterinary care associated with the evacuation shelters where animals were being brought. The agency in charge of the search and rescue efforts was the North Valley Animal Disaster Group, and they were spearheading the search and rescue campaigns. We did send a faculty with them for 1 day in order to determine whether or not additional veterinary needs were being met during those search and rescue efforts. And we found that for the campfire, utilizing us as veterinary care at the evacuation shelters was going to be the best for the animals.
And tell us about the animals. What kinds of wounds and problems were you seeing? Were they mostly burns, irritation from the smoke? What kind of veterinary care did those animals need when you first, you know, came upon them?
Yes, of course. The needs were varied. I mean, when we think of fires, the first ailment that comes to mind is a burn. And we saw a lot of them. Depending on the species of animal that we were treating, the burns could be located anywhere from their legs to their actual head area. And even for some of the shorter animals like pigs and sheep, we were seeing burns on their stomach and whole kind of abdomen area. And so that was something that we were really focused on treating. But additionally, having the smoke and debris in the air can cause other veterinary medical needs. And we were seeing a decent amount of eye issues. So, you know, the animals come in contact with debris in the air, and it they don't have a hand by which to remove those particles from their eye. And so that can cause ulceration and irritation of the eye. And so we were treating animals for different eye-related injuries. Additionally, we did see some respiratory conditions. So just from the poor air quality and amount of debris in the air, we did see some animals that were suffering from minor respiratory conditions that usually showed signs of just coughing and, you know, discharge from their nose and things like that. And then in any emergency and in any disaster, there is a certain amount of panic. And in that panic, animals can cause trauma to themselves by running into things or having issues being loaded into trailers. And so we did see lacerations and punctures. So that is, you know, very deep cuts and holes in the animals that were caused by different things that they encountered during the high stress situation of evacuating from a fire area.
Yeah, and I recall, you know, a lot of activity on social media of people saying, hey, make sure your horses are turned loose. You know, don't let them get trapped. I'm not sure if you can answer this or not, but I'd like to ask you, what are the instincts of animals when they're in a fire? Is it to just run away? Or I mean, I know some wild animals actually go towards the flame front, you know, instinctively knowing that once they get past that into the burned area, it's actually safer than running away from the fire, which is what firefighters are often taught. Can you address that a little bit?
Yeah, so you made a really great point, which it is varied by species. So depending on the type of animal, they're going to have different instincts. But we often see that prey animals, so horses and cows and sheep and a lot of our domestic herbivores, are prey animals, and they tend to flee, which is to try to move away from anything that is alarming to them. The problem is that we have created, as humans, a lot of infrastructure and man-made obstacles that prohibit animals from moving away from fires. And so it definitely depends on the animal and also their physical condition. So an animal that is able to run, is in good athletic condition, can move away quickly and potentially sustain that flight for a long time. But an animal that has is older or is afflicted by a different medical condition may not be able to move away from the fire as quickly as they need to.
Oh, that's interesting, and it makes sense. We're with the horses in particular. We didn't lose any horses, did we? Did all the horses get rescued off the ridge?
So all the horses that we treated recovered successfully, and we're very proud to say that because it took an incredible effort and a extremely dedicated team. Veterinarians and volunteers and animal care people. And so the animals that we were treating at the evacuation shelter all recovered from their injuries. But of course, there are animals that we are unaware of that may have not been brought to the evacuation shelter that could have suffered more.
Oh, yeah. And one of the things I saw in your article that kind of caught my attention was, and I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing this right, something called Manuka honey. Can you tell us about what that's used for?
Of course, yeah. So as UC Davis Veterinary School, we are constantly trying to improve the medical treatment of animals and use evidence-based medicine to make sure that we are treating wounds as effectively as possible. And so a article came out of Australia, and we actually were in contact with the author of the article that after an Australian bushfire, the horses were treated with a different variety of topical medications in order to soothe and help with the healing process of the burns. And what that article found was that Manuka honey, which is basically just a high grade level of honey, but it actually, even honey that you buy at the supermarket has similar properties, which is that it is extremely antimicrobial. And what that means is that by putting the honey on top of the burn, it doesn't allow for bacteria and other things that will irritate and infect the burn to get to the skin surface. And that creates an environment that allows the skin to heal more effectively. And so we were utilizing that paper and also information from veterinary professionals and found that Manuka honey was a really great way to treat some of the burns on these animals. Of course, Manuka honey is a more expensive product, so we were also using other topical medications that have long-standing been used in the veterinary profession for horses, like silver sulfadiazine. And so between Manuka honey and silver sulfadiazine, those were our primary topical meds used on the horses from Butte County.
We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll continue our conversation with veterinary student Haley Diekman as we talk about the efforts of UC Davis veterinarians treating animals rescued from the deadly campfire last November in Paradise, California. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's continue our visit with veterinary student Haley Diekman as we talk about the UC Davis Veterinary School's emergency veterinary care for animals in the aftermath of the deadly campfire.
Are there any animals in particular, horses and perhaps their owners, that really stand out in your mind, a story you could tell us about, something that was really meant something special to you?
Yeah, of course. The truth is that I met a lot of people, and each of them will always stay with me just in their dedication to their animals and the true bond that they had with their horse that made them so concerned about their care, and that the horse was part of their family, and having them being well taken care of meant so much to just the owner's well-being. And in a time of such difficulty, to have their animals well taken care of meant the world to them. And we were really lucky to meet a lot of people. One person that comes to mind is actually a family. They brought their kids with them, two young children, and their horse at the time was located in an area where we had set up a temporary quarantine. In any disaster situation, we as veterinary professionals become very concerned with any potential infectious diseases that could be contagious to the animals around them. And so we had created a makeshift quarantine area in order to try to separate some of the animals that we were concerned about. And their horse was in that quarantine area, and they had come to find me to determine why their horse was behind this kind of more elaborate fencing and how he was doing. And the amount of care and concern they had for their animal was truly tremendous. And they were so invested in hearing about how he was doing. And thankfully, he was recovering. He was an older horse, and therefore we were concerned about some underlying medical conditions that he may have, and making sure that he was being monitored more closely. And the appreciation they had for the individual care that we were providing for their horse was incredible. And they came up to me the next day and wanted another update. And every day I saw them until they were able to actually take their horse home, not to their home, unfortunately, but they had found new accommodations and made a priority of moving their animal out from the evacuation shelter and back with them. And they were just truly devastated by what had happened to their home, but were really uplifted by the fact that we were there to take care of their horse and provide him with the best veterinary care that we could. And they every day checked in and were so excited to greet me. And I have to say that meant so much to me working up there, because the days were long and they were challenging. But interacting with people that were appreciative and that wanted to know more and were truly invested in their animal made it all worthwhile, because for those owners, having their horse go home with them at the end of the 5 days that he was with us meant the world. So it was an incredible experience working with them.
Do you remember the name of the horse?
Unfortunately, I don't. At the time, we were mainly identifying the horses by the location that they were being housed in order to make sure to not confuse them. So unfortunately, I don't have a name of that animal, but he was a beautiful gray older horse that was incredibly friendly, loved a good carrot or an apple that you could provide to him as you were walking around checking on all of the animals.
Well, I hope somebody that knows that horse, perhaps the owners hear this and get in touch with me and let me know, because I'd really like to know. How many horses were you guys treating, like at the peak?
Yeah, well, that number definitely varies. And the truth is that some animals were at the evacuation shelter and they didn't require veterinary care. They were just being held there as temporary housing before their owners could figure out a new place to move them to. And then others were under direct veterinary care. And so I think for the shelter itself, at one point had over 700 animals, and that included horses and sheep and goats and cows and pigs and a lot of chickens. And I think at its max, we had over 100 horses at the facility. And I think under direct veterinary care, we have records of it, of at least 60 horses, and probably more, but given just how transient some animals were with us and kind of just the massive influx of animals that would come to the shelter in a given day, I don't right now have exact numbers, but I would say over 60 horses were treated over the duration of our 12 days in Butte County and countless other animals.
And those must have been difficult conditions for you veterinarians with the smoke and everything. And how long a days were you working while you were there?
Yeah, the days were challenging. And I think that what will always stick with me is the community that was created up there. And within that community, everyone was very focused on reminding each other of self-care. And that was something that, as a leader of the veterinary emergency response team, was definitely on my mind, which was that I needed to make sure that the students and faculty and staff that were volunteering their time to care for these injured animals were also taking the time to care for themselves. And so because of that, the volunteer group every day was changed so that everyone could have time off to rest and recuperate. And I would say on average, we worked 10-hour days, and then we were relieved by a second shift that then worked another 10-hour day, so that the animals were having around-the-clock care. And during that time, we were trying our best to maintain personal protective equipment, such as masks and things, to try to reduce the amount of exposure that we were having ourselves to the debris in the air from the fire. But they were definitely long days, and we created a real group of people that were dedicated to working and making sure that those people also took the time to take care of themselves outside of the fire.
One of the things I'd like to share with you is that I was a horse owner in Paradise, but long ago, probably before you were born, and back about 1979-80, and one of my favorite things to do is he was a big Morgan sorrel horse named Tamerlane, and he was a great trail horse. And so I used to love to ride him from Paradise over to Concow and Polga and back, which was a really long ride over Sawmill Peak and on logging roads and dirt roads and trails. And it was kind of like, you know, it was fulfilled my fantasy of being out in the Old West on a horse. And it was a lot of fun, but it, you know, I kept flashing on the route that I used to take to do that big ride, which took about eight hours, was basically the same route of where the campfire originated in Polga, and those embers came back over and destroyed Paradise. So I thought about that when I read your article. That's like, yeah, you know, that's where I used to ride my horse, was where the embers traveled in a more direct route, but that was the same trip I used to take on my horse. And I kept thinking, wow, what if I had a horse up there and what it would have been like for me as a horse owner and horse lover. So I really appreciate the work that you did and your team aiding these animals that went through such trauma as everyone, every animal and every person did on the ridge on that terrible day in November.
Yeah, I mean, that's an incredible story. And I feel like you must feel so connected to the people of Paradise, and like I do, from being up there and seeing the destruction that a wildfire can leave, and you know, how hard it must be for every owner of an animal to keep in mind not only their own safety and health, but the safety of their animal as well.
Do you know, like, where exactly were you treating the animals? Were there multiple locations or one place in particular where most of the horses were?
Yeah, so for the large animals, there was just one evacuation shelter, and that was located at the Butte County Fairgrounds in Gridley. As for the small animal facilities that we also ended up working at, there were three initial facilities throughout Butte County, and then they were consolidated into the Del Oro Small Animal Facility in Oroville.
And when did you personally first get interested in being a veterinarian?
Yeah, well, much like many veterinarians, I had an interest in becoming a veterinarian from a very young age. As long as I can remember, I've loved animals and was really interested in being a part of their medical care. And I think that started from just about as long as I can remember. And then I started riding horses when I was 7 and had a long career riding horses and training horses in the Bay Area. And during that time, just became really involved in a community and understood what owners were looking for in veterinary care and how to be a resource to them to improve the health of their animal, and how interested I was in becoming someone who could help a community of horse owners. And so I think that was kind of always my goal. And throughout high school and college, I kept in mind that that what I wanted to do was become a veterinarian. And I worked hard to try to facilitate, you know, the extracurricular experiences and the grades required to get into veterinary school, and have never looked back. It's been a career that I feel very drawn to and am excited about having a long future in.
Well, that was interesting because I know as an educator myself at the high school level, I run into a lot of kids because I live in a rural area, Corning, California. I live in Red Bluff, but a lot of our kids, you know, that have that dream growing up of wanting to be a vet, wanting to be a veterinarian. But for some reason or another, that, you know, falls by the wayside, because what you do and what you're doing, it's very difficult academically. It takes a lot of work and dedication. Is there any advice that you could give to perhaps somebody listening to this program, a young person or somebody who knows one that really wants to be a vet? What are a couple of tips you would give them to perhaps make that dream come true?
Yeah, of course. I would always appreciate as many tips as I could get when I was working towards entering veterinary school. And I think that a lot of people focus on making sure that you have good grades and take the appropriate science courses. And I think that's really important. I think just not only taking the courses, but investing the time into being excited about the information and recognizing that that's going to be the base by which you're going to build an incredible amount of medical knowledge. But beyond just the classroom learning, I think one thing that I really have found from my own experience and those of classmates at the veterinary school is that you want to have passions and show that you are willing to be a leader or a community member or a volunteer or whatever it is that you can find that makes you excited about serving your community. And so when I was in high school, I worked at a therapeutic riding center, and I worked my way up and soon started teaching children with physical and mental disabilities how to ride horses. And I found that that connection that I saw between these children and horses was something that I was truly dedicated to. And I think that finding something that makes you excited about your community and being able to give back to your community is a really important thing about becoming a veterinarian and is a way to make you stand out. I also think that any experiences outside of science are also very important, that that if you're interested in history or teaching or language arts, that pursuing those activities as well makes you a well-rounded applicant, and that those things can be really important and make you stand out from all the other 4.0 students, is having something that you can show how interested you are and how you've taken that to the next level by really dedicating yourself to improving or serving or whatever it is. But I have found that you need that basis in hard sciences, but also creating a person that's really interested in helping others is something that's going to make you stand out on any application.
Thanks to our guest, Haley Diekman from the UC Davis School of Veterinary Medicine. After a short break, we'll return with a visit with Brian Solecki. He's the campaign manager for congressional candidate Audrey Denny. After her unsuccessful bid to unseat an incumbent Republican representative in California's 1st District, Denny and Solecki turned their attention to helping survivors of the campfire during their trip to Washington, D.C. a month after the fire. Stay with us. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Our next guest is Brian Solecki, campaign manager for congressional candidate Audrey Denny. After her unsuccessful bid to unseat an incumbent Republican representative in California's 1st District, Doug LaMalfa, Denny and Solecki turned their attention to helping survivors of the campfire during a trip to Washington, D.C. a month after the fire, as they met government and environmental leaders. Solecki joined us from our studio in Chico, California. Brian Solecki, welcome to Blue Dot.
Hey, thanks, Dave. It's great to be with you.
I'd like to start out by talking a little bit about you, because you kind of have an interesting similarity with me in terms of your educational background. You were, what, a geosciences major at California State University, Chico? Is that right?
I was actually a geology major at Chico State. I was the, I believe, the last graduating class from the geology department before it combined and became part of the geoscience department.
And when you did that, did you have any idea that someday you would be a campaign manager for the first congressional district? Did you envision that at all?
I mean, I think at that point in my life, I envisioned myself getting to camp outside a lot and be in the geologic world.
Yeah. And my daughter's a geologist, so, and she started there at CSU Chico, so she actually does that. I'd like to know, though, how did you become a campaign manager with your background as a geologist?
Wow, that is going to be quite a tale. The short version is I went from geology to theology. I ended up getting my master's degree in theological studies and became an ordained pastor and spent 20 years as an ordained pastor. Most recently, I spent 10 years here at Bidwell Presbyterian Church, just across the street from the studio on the other side of the park. Primarily involved the last few years in kind of reaching out to the young adult population of Chico, kind of doing things outside the box, really working to serve our community and reach a population that historically wasn't very connected to the church world. It was in that environment that I met Audrey Denny. She was a member of our leadership team, and we partnered a lot together on a bunch of different projects. And then when the Oroville Dam disaster happened, she and I ended up working with the team, doing resource management, working with all the different shelters all across Butte County. And that was our first opportunity to really work in that kind of environment together. And then when she had this crazy harebrained idea to run for Congress, she came to me one day and said, I'm thinking about running for Congress, and I'm thinking you should lead the campaign. And I remember thinking, you're crazy, and that's a crazy idea. And then she spent the next few months campaigning. Her first campaign was actually to my wife to convince her of this idea. And lo and behold, next thing I knew, I was quitting my job, and my wife was going to work full-time at Enloe Hospital as a nurse. And we set off on this adventure just over a year ago. I think it was January 21st was my first day working for Audrey.
Well, and our listeners to the podcast, you know, are not from around these parts. Think of California as a very Democratic place, but I don't recall, has there ever been a Democrat that's ever won the first congressional district in modern times?
Well, the district's been redrawn a few times over the last few decades, but 1974 was the last time this geographic area was represented by a Democrat in Congress.
Okay, well, that makes sense. Well, let's talk about you ran a valiant campaign and lost to Doug LaMalfa as the representative for your district. But then right after that, just a couple of days, wasn't it, was the campfire. Am I right about that? It was just days afterwards.
Yeah, correct. It was about 36 hours later. November 6th was the election, and we finished that election season with this huge party at the El Rey. We had about 1,000 people come out to really celebrate. And, you know, we learned pretty early on that evening that Audrey wasn't going to win her race. But we really believed it was a night to celebrate, that we helped lead a resurgence of energy and people across District 1 kind of taking control of their democracy and getting involved and participating in a way that we haven't seen in recent history. And so we really turned that night into just a celebration of democracy. And it was a great night for us all. Well, maybe not quite for Audrey, but the rest of us had a fantastic evening. And then the next day, spent the day recovering and celebrating, and all of our key volunteers and staff. And then the next morning was the fire. And so, yeah, there was not much time for us to recover. Our kind of view and dream of getting this opportunity just to rest and relax definitely did not happen.
Well, it's interesting, as I find all of this, the real reason I asked you on the program was to talk about a group of campfire survivors, some of whom I met last week at CSU Chico's sustainability conference. You guys went to Washington together. Could you just tell us a bit about how did that come about? Whose idea was that, and how did that happen?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, it's kind of a blur in terms of how it all came together, because it happened so quickly. If I remember correctly, a gentleman named Nirvan Mullick, who I know you've met, he spoke last week at the event. He reached out to some mutual friends about wanting to help organize a group of these people that he had seen a story about on the news, this group of nurses from Feather River Hospital who had been trapped. And at the time was when there was some Butte County Sheriff body cam footage that had been released and it kind of gone viral across the internet. And so he wanted to help send those people to D.C. And so somewhere along in that process, we got connected and they said, we'd love to have somebody who felt a little bit more comfortable in the political realm to help lead that. And so Audrey and I got volunteered to get involved. And a couple days later, we were rolling, and we had organized about 17 meetings with different congressional representatives and senators and leaders in the climate change movement. And really the goal of the trip was, one, to participate in a climate change town hall that Bernie Sanders was sponsoring, but then also was just to spend as much time as we could really lobbying, to be honest. It was spending time with these elected officials and making sure they understood the scale of what had happened here. Seeing the scenes on the television or reading about it on the internet couldn't communicate the scale of destruction that we were talking about. And as we spent time in Washington over those 2 days, it became pretty clear quite quickly that they were really struggling to understand how to respond because they didn't have a model to use. And some of the people we talked to said they were kind of comparing what they saw happening in Paradise in Megalia in Butte County to kind of a hybrid of, in terms of how to respond, a hybrid of 9/11 and Puerto Rico, where you had this destructive scale of Puerto Rico on a smaller geographic basis, of course, but you had this regional trauma that the people of New York experienced. Because I know for those of you who are familiar with what happened on that November 8th, people were traumatized. I know I have close friends who are really still struggling with the life and death nature of that morning.
Yes, and you know that just about the entire town was virtually destroyed, which was, you know, pretty unprecedented in California history. The only thing that I can compare it to is the San Francisco earthquake and fire of 1906. Can you tell us a bit about who exactly went on that trip to Washington? How many of the survivors were there?
So we led a group of four of the campfire survivors. We had three of those nurses, of the four nurses from Feather River who were involved in that incident, and also an educator from Chico State, a woman named Susan, who lost her home and also had a really traumatic and harrowing escape that day. Audrey and I were there, and then Matt Plotkin was there as well. He is the co-chair of what is now the Butte County Long-Term Recovery Group. And so he was there as well as we had a documentary film crew that was following us around and a number of other people associated with that.
And you met with a lot of very interesting, important, powerful people. I'm also curious, did you also meet with Bill McKibben, the famous climate change activist? Was he part of this?
We did. We met with pretty much all elected officials, and the exception to that was with Bill McKibben, and also we met with the leaders of the Sunrise Movement. But Bill was a joy to get to spend some time with. He was running around. He was participating in Bernie Sanders' town hall that evening, and so he said, I'd love to meet with you. Can you meet me at this pub around the corner from the Capitol? And so part of this surreal 2 days we had there was getting to spend a couple of hours in a pub in Washington, D.C. With this person who I've read books of and kind of looked up to, and just having the opportunity to have him listen to the stories. For the most part, Matt and Audrey and I just tried to get out of the way and let the campfire survivors tell their story. There's nothing we needed to add to it. We were there just to help kind of guide the conversation and give them the opportunity to share their story.
Yeah, and to be clear, this is after the election. At this point, there's no plan to run again for election in this next election cycle, which we can talk about in a moment. You're just there shepherding these survivors through. Can you tell us about maybe something that you remember that sticks in your mind, one of the experiences that you saw one of the survivors have with any of the officials they met with?
You know, I would say the best example of that is really kind of the big picture narrative of how they developed in their storytelling. When we went into our first meeting the first morning was with Congressman Mike Thompson from the neighboring congressional district here in Northern California. And they were terrified. You know, here's people, they're in the room with people they see on TV, that they read about in the newspaper. And I think every one of them expressed a significant sense of, why am I here? What is it that I have to say? Who am I to tell anything to these people? And you fast forward, you know, 24 hours later, and they're sitting with Bernie Sanders himself and Bill McKibben and Nancy Pelosi and John Garamendi and these other officials in D.C., and they are just speaking powerfully. They weren't feeling that insecurity any longer. They were on a mission, and they believed that they had a purpose of being there in D.C. for those 2 days. And so it was an incredible process to watch. To see them find their voice and speak out. And really the message that they were taking to each elected official was that they are the face of climate change disasters. We think so much of climate change and the disasters that could come from it as this far off thing. We think about how it's going to affect our kids or our grandkids. And they really refined this conviction that this isn't something in the future. This is something in the present. And we've entered into a new era that we need to act and we need to respond. And so they were really calling strongly for these representatives to put their weight behind climate change action. They were putting their weight behind making sure Butte County gets the resources they need to recover and move forward. And they went from being nurses and educators who experienced a traumatic event to being strong and vocal advocates for their homes, their friends and family in Butte County, and for climate change action.
And I'm just curious about, you know, you personally, with your background in science, have you found that to be helpful in helping to communicate the science of climate change when you're having these kinds of interactions, or at least, you know, maybe having interactions with the campfire survivors, you know, before and after these meetings they were having?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I'm reaching way back into the way back machine here, but you know, it was a couple decades ago when I was a geology undergrad, one of the things I loved about that major in particular was that it was such a major based, or such a study field based on observation, that you would go out in the field after having studied these concepts in books, and then you would go out into the field and look at the rocks and determine what was happening and how does that tell the story of what has happened in the past and what can we infer from or what that means to the future. And so carrying that forward, I find myself to be an observer. And I think for those of us who are observers and looking at the facts and the data and the what we see happening across our planet, there's no doubt that there is something going on that's different. And what we're seeing in terms of climate change, disasters are only increasing in severity and how often they're happening. And what we saw in Paradise and Butte County is, unfortunately, it's the future unless we actually really start doing something about it.
I'm also curious, after this event and with your work as a pastor there in the Chico area, have you noticed a shift now in the way that people that are basically conservative and in this area, which has had a long history of climate change denial, the current representative, Doug LaMalfa, has repeatedly denied the science of climate change. And one of the most famous climate change deniers in the country, Anthony Watts, is from this region. But have you noticed within the people you minister to, perhaps, or just encounter in our area, have you noticed a shift in their views towards climate change after the campfire?
I think what I've mostly noticed is an increased awareness that something is different. Maybe some people who are climate change deniers might not be connecting the dots yet, but there's a lot more questions being asked. There's a lot more curiosity. There's a lot more concern being expressed. And so some of those people who might hold those viewpoints might not have landed or shifted at this point. But I definitely see a curiosity, I guess you could say, in terms of there's something going on and I'm not quite sure how to define what's causing it or even exactly what it is, but something is happening. Mm.
Well, we're about out of time, but could you just share with us what was the big takeaway for you and your candidate and Audrey Denny after this experience of going to Washington with the survivors? I see that she has decided to run again in this very difficult to win district. Did that play a role in her decision?
Absolutely. There was a moment at the end of our 2 days there, the survivors from Paradise had already left and we had one more meeting with a congressman. And this was the most productive meeting we had. We walked in and he called his entire staff in and said, you guys all need to be in this meeting. And we talked about what had gone on here in Butte County. And he talked about the resources he was trying to get to us and what he was planning on doing and all these action plans. And then he actually had to run because it was actually the night that George H.W. Bush was coming to be laid in state in the rotunda. And so he was running to that. And he said, Audrey, I'm giving you, as much time as you want with my entire staff. And out the door he went. And Audrey and I sat there and kind of looked at each other and then proceeded to kind of spend about an hour with his staff talking about plans and how we move forward and what we need and advocating for the constituents here in Northern California. And after we walked out of that meeting, Audrey looked at me and I could see there was a spark in her eye and she said, I'm meant to be here and I'm meant to do this really well. This is who I am and I'm going to be here. And from that moment on, there was never even the slightest moment of doubt that she would be running again in 2020.
Well, on that note, I'm going to have to let you go because we're out of time, but I do appreciate you coming in to talk to us about this and for taking those survivors and helping them navigate the process because that has to be very intimidating for an average citizen to go through the trauma of that fire and that life-changing event and then have to go to Washington, D.C. and share that with their elected officials. So thank you very much for that.
Absolutely, Dave. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks again to our guests, Brian Selecki, campaign manager for California congressional candidate Audrey Denny, and Haley Diekman, third-year veterinary student at the University of California School of Veterinary Medicine. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio. You can check out this and past episodes at mynspr.org. Never miss an episode. Subscribe to us on NPR podcasts via the NPR One app, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Blue Dot is distributed by PRX. Hey, that's the Public Radio Exchange. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. Our producer and engineer is Mr. Blue, Sky Schofield. Our associate producer and owner of a dog named Rocket is Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.